Welcome to the Driving Change Podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network, where we live at the intersection of neuroscience and storytelling. If you love great stories and you love understanding the mindset it takes to be a world-class change agent, then join us as our fascinating guests from all walks of life unpack their unique journeys of perseverance and passion, of expertise and experience, and be inspired to use your own story to drive change. Welcome back to the Driving Change Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Jeff Bloomfield. And I want you to imagine to yourselves for a second that you have lived a life where you grew up in the shadows of some of the most famous goalposts and NFL players, watching your father hike the ball to Bart Starr and Johnny Unitas and listening to the gruff voice of Vince Lombardi. And then I want you to imagine a life that took you on a journey that allowed you to actually be connected to some of the most impressive professional athletes in the world, people like Payne Stewart. And then I want you to imagine being connected to the tragedy that happened with Payne Stewart. Then I want you to imagine a life where you are so passionate to mentor young college students from your own perspective, but then you're directly connected to things like the school shooting that happened in Virginia back in November of 22. And your life journey has led you into all these interconnected triumphs and tragedies. That's the story, partially, of today's guest, Bill Curry Jr. And if you recognize that name, because Bill Curry Sr. obviously was the gentleman who played in the NFL all those years, and he actually was teammates of Bart Starrs and Johnny Unitas. And Bill Curry Jr., our guest today, grew up learning some of those lessons, but also creating a path of his own. And some of the life lessons that he's learned, I can't wait for you to hear today, because I think you're going to find they're going to directly apply to you and I as well. So, Bill, welcome to the Driving Change Podcast. It's an honor to have you on.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm really energized by the opportunity and just appreciate having the time to visit.
Now, you've got one of those interesting lives that when I see and hear the backstory, because we're roughly the same age, I'm always intrigued and fascinated to unpack some of those stories, because you've got a little bit of Forrest Gump in you, the way your life has gone. You know, you've got all these different things happen to you that have made you who you are today. But I want to start with the beginning. Let's go back in the origin story. And like our guests are used to, or our audience is used to listening to our guests, tell us back in the early days, what was it like being little Billy growing up in that shadow of the goalpost of Lambeau Field? And what were some of the biggest influences that you had in your life, obviously being around that kind of environment? Who made you who you are today? And tell us a little bit of that early journey.
Wow. Well, you know, Jeff, when I think about my earliest memories, it's funny. We hear our parents tell the story of our birth over and over again. If you want to think about it, way back in the late 60s, early 70s, with the advent of Monday Night Football, I was actually born on a Tuesday. And the reason I always remember that I was born on a Tuesday was because my dad played on Monday Night Football the night before, and he loves to tell the story of coming back. He was in Baltimore at the time playing for the Colts and meeting me for the first time. And I kind of grew up in the environment of an NFL locker room. And my dad was this larger than life persona. He was the president of the NFL Players Association. And we had folks coming and going from our house all the time. I could never understand why all the neighbors came out to see, whether it was a Bart Starr or Freddie Dreyer or a Bubba Smith and Tom Maddie and people like that. And so very early on, I realized the enormity, in my opinion, of my mom, my dad, and you know how dutiful my mom was and had to follow him. We'd move twice a year, every year. And it's funny, too, because in the early 70s, and this will date me, but when Lee Majors played the $6 million man on TV, my dad kind of had the same look. And I can remember just having this big, strong dad. And then a few years later, he'd get hurt and he'd lose his job in the NFL because that's what happens to aging offensive centers in the National Football League. And I grew a very close attachment early on to the relationship between performance and employment. We can talk more about that later. But I truly idolized my dad and these men and had the opportunity to be right by his side as he ascended, really coming out of playing, he wrote a book with George Plimpton in 1976 called One More July that documents this craziness of going to his last NFL training camp. And the next thing I know, he's coaching in Green Bay with Bart Starr being the head coach. And I think as we get older, time compresses. And by the time he got to Green Bay, I was 7 or 8 years old when he was coaching at that point. But then, man, that was just about a decade after those glory, those Packer teams. And so all those alumni were there, and the impact of Coach Lombardi on his life had a direct impact on my life. And there was a lot of good, and there was some real tough stuff too. You know, when you talk about being a young kid, the expectation was we do things right all the time. Not some of the time, all the time. And if we're going to be on time, we're going to be on Lombardi time. We're going to be 15 minutes early. But I had great parents who taught me from a very young age the value of great effort, accountability, the kind of things you learn in the huddle, being a great teammate. And at the same time, I grew up as Bill Curry's son, primarily because once he became a head coach, left Green Bay and went to Georgia Tech and then ultimately the University of Alabama. I can't tell you the amount of times I was introduced as Bill Curry's son, and I could lose myself in that. And it became a very strong anchor for me. And so it had a direct impact on decisions that I made later in my youth to want to go out and be my own person. And so as I got a little bit older and into high school, it determined my future and what I was going to do. And I wasn't a great student. My mom was a PhD in history and so desperately wanted me to be a scholar and play piano and be anything other than this meathead football player. But like so many, I saw my dad. And when I say that I was close to football as a teenager, both at Georgia Tech and at the University of Alabama, by the time I was in my mid-teens, I had a headset on the sidelines because my dad wouldn't wear a headset. And I was giving him plays from the box upstairs. And so I got to experience, you know, Auburn, Alabama, Georgia Tech, right in the middle of it from very, very early age, and wanted to be a player myself because I wanted to be just like my dad. So what did I do? I pushed myself as an athlete. And in the first play of my first game as a high school player, I tore my knee to pieces in the first play of my first high school varsity start as a 10th grader. The net result of that was that I graduated from high school only having played 15 high school football games. And so here I am. My dad, by this point, is the head football coach at the University of Alabama. He took the job 3 years after their legendary head coach, Bear Bryant, retired, and then Ray Perkins coached for 3 years. And then my dad took the job, and I couldn't even walk. And I finally get to play some more football as a senior in high school. I wasn't a very good student. I was a decent football player because when I was in 10th grade, I was almost my dad's size by then. And so I was a pretty big kid and got recruited some. But by the time I became a senior, I didn't have a whole lot of film. And as luck would have it, the University of Virginia, Mr. Jefferson's academical village, he comes calling. And I have the opportunity to go to the University of Virginia, but I had a really small, significant problem. And that was my grade point average and my SAT score from a competitive perspective. So I want you to imagine being a high school senior in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, with an opportunity to go to Alabama to play football for my dad, or the University of Virginia, who was getting good in the late 80s. And around, this is by the late 80s, the head coach was George Welsh, who was a Hall of Famer, very gruff guy. And they took my transcript and they got me into school. So the phone call came to my mother one night, and it was one of the coaches, and he shared with my mom that I had gained admission into the University of Virginia. And that was when I learned that I would be going to the University of Virginia for college. And that's how I ended up here in Charlottesville, where I live now, having moved back here about 10 years ago with our five children and my wife, Kelly.
Was there any dialogue at that point, like between you and your dad around Alabama versus Virginia and what that looked like? Or was he like, this is your path? I knight you, go on with my blessing. How'd that conversation look?
So his tenure at the University of Alabama was successful objectively, but culturally he wasn't the most popular fit in the state of Alabama because my dad was a Georgia Tech graduate and former Georgia Tech player. And that rivalry wasn't the friendliest, but he had had some success building the Georgia Tech program. And I actually had more appeal, in other words, more recruiting effort from his staff than him. He really wanted me, I do believe, he wanted me to get away from some of the tension that existed there just because of the family name. And keep in mind,
right,
I went from the Lovett School in Atlanta, Georgia, when he was at Georgia Tech, to Tuscaloosa Central. I mean, diametric opposites as it relates to a lot of things, both amazing experiences. But I was very much Bill Curry's boy, Bill Curry's son in Alabama. And when I went to the University of Virginia, he knew that I would be William Alexander Curry Jr. and have a chance to set out on my own. So being the brilliant husband that he was and knowing that his wife wanted me to go study at the University of Virginia, he got behind UVA pretty quick, if you can imagine.
Right, right. That makes sense.
A real blessing for sure.
So are you feeling pretty good at that time? Like you're like, okay, you know, I'm lucky to be here after the injury and I got my senior year in, I got a scholarship, I'm in Virginia, I'm able to do this. Are you starting to feel a little bit like, yeah, I'm going to start to carve my own name out now? Like what was going on there?
Well, ironically, my first year was as non-scholarship because I didn't have enough high school film. And I give Coach Welsh a lot of credit. I earned a scholarship after the first spring, my first spring practice. And I was feeling pretty good at that point. But I also knew that the University of Virginia was not going to be the frenzied environment that the University of Alabama football was. So I thought, because my first game playing football for the University of Virginia was the second game of the 1990 season. It was the first home game, and it was against Clemson on national TV. And we had lost to Clemson 29 times in a row. And I had to snap football. I had to snap for punts as a redshirt freshman in the rain against Clemson. And I was in puddles myself in the locker room prior to that game from fear. And that's when I learned out what real leadership was, because that 1990 team had great leadership that helped me gain confidence from the first time I was in a team environment. And I didn't know if I could do it. I didn't know, but we had a quarterback named Sean Moore and some defensive leaders, like men like Tony Covington, that I could look in their eyes and see their belief in me. And that was the first time I felt the real power of mentorship, of a leader's love for someone who had never really proven themselves, but having faith in me. And I was ultimately successful that season, and it changed my life forever. And oh, by the way, 7 weeks into the season, we were number one in the nation. Everybody in the world was all over the University of Virginia. This has obviously only happened one time. It's been a long time since we were really good. But it created a unique experience because that was also the first time that I ever went to a public place with my dad, because by this time he had left. By my second year at UVA, he had left University of Alabama to go to the University of Kentucky. And my family was introduced at a restaurant to friends of a family. And it was the first time that my dad was ever introduced as Bill Curry's dad. And so that's a moment that, I mean, I could almost get choked up just thinking about it, not because of any kind of self-centered pride or anything like that, but just more than anything was what my parents gave to me was the burning desire to be the best that I could be. And in spite of the injury problems I have, somehow I found my way into the University of Virginia. Somehow I found my way onto the field after only playing in 15 high school football games. And somehow I'm playing on the number one team in the nation. And it was the first time in my life where you start to see things as, wait, you could, this, no possible, how does this happen? How did I get here? I didn't think I could do it. And there's a life force that's inside of great teams, where you put together great people. And at times like that, when you're running out there under those lights and all those people and all that pressure, and even though I never played in the NFL, when you're out there in the field of competition under that kind of pressure, you don't care who's watching. You don't hear the crowd. You are supported and put into what I call the sixth dimension. And you're moving as a team in and out of that locker room. It creates an energy and a life force and a confidence that you take for the rest of your life. And so if anyone is blessed to join a team, to do something that they're not really sure that they can do, all these years later, I see those same men and feel the same thing that I felt sitting in the locker room before that Clemson game, that brotherhood. And man, it's worth more than any money, any gift, anything material that I've gained is the love of those leaders and teams and the inspiration that they put in me to be someone like that for someone else.
Isn't that the heart of it, though? I think you're getting at, I know you're now, I didn't do this in your intro, but I don't want to skip ahead too far. We'll come back to this. But now you're an executive leader inside the med tech space at a global, you know, Fortune 500 company. And the idea is, how do we create those team environments with our families and with the post in the workforce so that years later, people are like, when they see you and they worked for you, they're like, oh, I have the same feeling of I can do anything when I'm around that guy. Or when you're creating that for your family, right? Your kids look at you and go, I can do anything because my father spoke that I could do anything into me. And so when I'm having a moment of weakness, I call my dad. And I'm like, I can do anything. Like, isn't that the spirit of fatherhood, of leadership in so many ways?
It really is. And what a fascinating time to be a parent and a leader. And how closely, in a weird way, that they're related. And I'll relate a story to you that, Jeff, that happened to me when my parents moved to Kentucky when I was still playing college football. And I didn't remember this lesson for 31 years. We lived next to a horse farm that a Triple Crown winner was set to stud at, affirmed, who had won the Triple Crown, living in Jonabell Horse Farms. And we could walk into his stable with his trainer. And I'll never forget, I asked the trainer, how do you take care of a Triple Crown winner who's this powerful, this beautiful, this amazing? What's it like? He said, I spend 24 hours a day thinking of ways to prevent this horse from killing himself. And I didn't think about that again until I was put in a position as a, you know, I call it a shape the organization job. When you get jobs and you're contributing as a, whether you're in sales as an entry level, and then you become a sales manager, and then you're directing sales managers, and then you're directing directors who are managing sales managers, managing territory managers. When you get through those levels, and it's the same as I teach my kids, you get to a certain level where the real recognition is not Lombardi time. It's not we do things right all the time. It's we do our best and try not to make the same mistakes twice, because we have developed the kind of professionals in our culture where there's so much pressure. We internalize so much pressure. We become so self-centered. And by the way, when I say that, I mean me. These are mistakes that I've made where we don't cut ourselves enough slack to realize that something got me from the chubby little kid to the high school field, from the high school field to not playing, to a year off non-scholarship playing at University of Virginia, to earning a scholarship, to starting 47 games. I mean, all that happened. I don't know how that happened, but it's a blessing. And so why would I turn myself inside out as a 40-year-old professional stressing out about how I'm about to get fired, how I'm not good enough? But those are things that I suffered from personally. And the lesson I learned never hit me. After all those years, I go back to that thoroughbred example. One of the things I've tried to do in the last 5 years with managing high performers is, if you have empathy and spend a lot of time letting them be who they are, understanding that they're gonna be irrationally motivated to perform, how do you keep them from killing themselves? And when you approach them that way, it changes. It starts to feel a lot more like a, I think family is the wrong word, because it bothers me when people say team and family and think it's the same thing, because it isn't. I mean, if I get thrown in jail, somebody from my family is going to have to come bail me out. I can't do that on the job and expect to be bailed out. But the fact of the matter is the compassion and the empathy and the recognition that really believing in somebody is giving them the opportunity. And then once they have it, it's setting them loose and preventing them from hurting themselves.
No, because isn't that so true, though, that most really high performers are so driven that they will drive themselves into the ground. And if they're not given the right amount of coaching reinforcement on helping them see how to put them in a position to be successful, but also to, as you've learned in your own journey, is having those moments of recognition, of self-awareness. This is the irony for me, is the irony of this term self-awareness. It's usually it takes someone else to speak truth into your life in love for you to actually start to see that you have these spots in your life you need some extra help with. So it's called, we call it self-awareness, but it doesn't always start off as self-awareness, right? Someone usually has to speak that truth into you, and you have to be able to receive it. So as you're leading other people down that path, whether it's your own children, whether it's people in the workforce, is finding those people to speak that truth into you, and then becoming the type of leader that learns how, through empathy, through compassion, through great communication, being able to speak that truth into others to where they receive it versus resist it.
Well, I tell you, I had a unique opportunity, a byproduct of my association with the professional athletics environment. I mean, my earliest memories, my whole life, I've been around public people, one of whom was an agent my dad hired when he was at the University of Alabama named Robert Fraley, who came to a pregame meal in 1987. We were getting ready to play the Florida Gators. They had a freshman running back that had never played, who went for 200, ended up going for 220 yards and ruining our day. His name was Emmett Smith. This was 1987. And into the pregame meal with my dad, I'm 16 years old, walks this goofy guy, about 6 feet tall, utterly unimpressive. I didn't know who he was. I just knew he was my dad's agent. They sat down and they said, "Hi, Billy, this is Payne Stewart." So I'm 16 years old. At the time, Payne is 28, and he's a professional golfer. And so he had these wildly well-developed, I know this now, but he had these incredibly well-developed skills as a pro golfer. And he was 28. I was 16, and I had been there, done that, and seen a lot. And we went like this. And from that day till the day he died, we were buddies. And I traveled all over the world with him in college. I compromised more than one training camp by going over to the Dutch Open with him and the British right before football training camp. But then I was in that environment too, led me to the career that I had in pro sports before I got to med tech. And the reason that I associate that with this topic is there is an irrational level of ability that a Payne Stewart, a Tiger Woods, a Chipper Jones, who I worked with as well when he was playing third base for the Atlanta Braves when I was in sports management, they have these unbelievably well-developed skills at hitting a little ball 20 feet up a grassy hill into a cup in front of 10 million people. And they're just like, "Yeah, I don't get it. It's easy. I mean, it's a right to left. It's going to be one ball right. I'm going to hit it right in the center, win the U.S. Open. Watch me do it." And they can do it.
Right.
But if you hand them a microphone and say, "The dudes from Wendy's are here. They want you to give them 5 minutes on what it felt like to win the U.S. Open." It's like, "I don't know how to talk to them. What are you talking about? I can't. I'm not a public speaker." And so where does that come from there? I was with Payne during that period between him winning the U.S. Open in 1999 and he died on October 25th in the plane crash the very same year. And I saw what fame in 1999 felt like to him. But in the build to that, there was a 5-year darkness. Is the reason that I was with him is because we needed to get him more commercial opportunities because he hadn't been playing well. And due to a series of lifestyle changes that ironically we both made during that time period, he started to win again. And when he started to win again, was when he was performing the best as a father. It was when he was performing the best as a friend. And when he got back to the top as a major champion in 1999, I'll never forget it. He won the US Open on a Sunday. On Wednesday, I got a call in our office when I was working in sports management at Leader Enterprises in Orlando, Florida. He was going to do some press and he wanted me to come out and help him, which was his way of saying, I want you to come out and hang out with me. And I went out to his home and we got in his boat and pulled his son Aaron around the Butler Chain of Lakes in Orlando on a wakeboard. And he asked me, he said, what was that like Sunday? And this prior Sunday, he had beaten Phil Mickelson on the 18th hole at the US Open at Pinehurst on a par putt. It was a 20-footer uphill. It's pretty famous for golf fans. They've seen it on TV a million times. He had to make that putt to make par and win by one over Phil, who had missed his birdie putt, and he made it. And that Wednesday, he asked me, what did that feel like for you? I was like, oh, I mean, Kirk Gibson, 88 World Series, you know, one of the best sports moments of all time. And he was like, man, this ain't it. He was like, I would trade places with you today. And I said, why? And of course, I'm just like blown away because I'm like, hey, we're going to get a lot of stuff from this. We're going to do well from this.
Right.
He said, because you have a dad and I don't. Payne's dad had died when he was in his mid-20s from cancer. His dad was a salesman. His dad wore these amazingly memorable coats to work. So why did Payne wear the Knickers? Because he wanted to be like his dad. And on that summer day in June of 1999, Wednesday after winning the US Open, all he wanted to do was be available for his 10-year-old kid. And he said, if I win the British Open, I'm quitting. Obviously, that's not what happened. The US went on to win the Ryder Cup in September of the same year. And October 25th, 1999, I had been taken off of Payne's business. And that's all I had done for the year and a half prior to that. And I was angry. I wasn't devastated. I was pissed. But he got on a plane that day with my boss and my boss's boss, and they crashed in South Dakota 6 hours after they took off. And the only reason I wasn't on that plane was because I was no longer serving him. So you talk about things that are incidents that happen in your life, disappointments that you think you'll never forgive people for. That is a glaring way that my higher power, see, I'm stubborn. I had a deep faith, but I have to be hit right in the face with the obvious. And that happened in October of 1999, and I started my career in med tech January of 2000, like 2 months later. And I've been with the same organization ever since. So the last real gut check I had prior to launching into the career that I am now and an incredible family that I have was that circumstance.
Wow. So you were so close to, I mean, any number of different decisions by people beyond your control would have put you on that plane.
100%. 100%. And it's, and clearly I wasn't. So I don't need a pat on the back or a recognition that, oh, you're so, no, I wasn't near being on that plane, because as soon as, you know, I was hired to go get stuff for him as a young person that they could turn loose on tour. This was prior to the internet. And so imagine, they're like, we've got to find someone that can travel around the world with these pro golfers, because Paul Azinger and Payne Stewart were the two primary clients of ours in the golf. We were very boutique-y, and be able to hang and not humiliate us. How are you going to find a kid like that? And then somebody's like, what about Billy Curry? And they're like, oh my goodness. He's like, it's the only one, because I'd known him for so long. And my dad had been a client prior. And that, like I said, right before the internet. So I'm talking about like me going to tournaments, looking for unique opportunities. So that's how we got his business going again. And then we started to behave, and then he started to win, and then he was gone. But the last thing that he really, really was motivated to be was the best father that he could be. And that's the lesson.
Have you ever shared that story directly with his son?
You know, I have, but Jeff, to be totally transparent, Aaron's a great kid. I probably should spend a little bit more time one-on-one with him. I have shared that with the family. I don't know that I've ever gotten to that level of detail with how emotional that the conversation was, because it really was. Because, you know, it was very heavy, and it was such a blessing in to be able to articulate that, because the day of his passing, I am literally the person that read this family statement at the front door that afternoon, because we were made aware of the plane being out of communication while it was still in the air. And, you know, I was in the home while it was still in the air, and I was in the home when the kids came home, and it's all very overwhelming at the time. But that's when I realized,
I can only imagine,
in the blink of an eye, I have a career gone, tiny company. I was working for people. I wasn't in the profession because I was motivated to be there. I love the people I worked with.
Right.
And who would have known that when I picked up the phone, when it was over, I called the men from that locker room in 1990 to be rescued from that UBA team. The men that led me as a knucklehead, redshirt freshman, average football player, got the first phone call from me after the accident. And they got me, one of them happened to be a territory manager with my company in Atlanta. He got me my first interview and I got the job. So
wow.
The thread through all of it is the love of a leader with compassion for someone who could do nothing for them, really could contribute, but that they needed, being given the trust to do something, doing it to the best of their abilities, finding a way to be all right at it, so that someday we would reconvene in that brotherhood, the way that that ties to my alma mater, to my history, to learning those lessons from my father in those locker rooms, to meeting the people I've met, put me in a position to develop in the career that I'm in right now, but more importantly, be a role model to our five sons and an excellent provider to my wife, which is what it's all about.
So we don't run out of time. I also want to touch on, because I know that you've had, I don't know what the best way to describe this is, but and it's not just an epiphany. You've had a marked change in your direction of your purpose that really kind of culminated in that shooting that took place on campus. And I know that that shooting really moved you more than just empathetically for the families of those football players, but it changed you, if I understand correctly, to where it really pivoted you to kind of release this hold that fear had had on your life. And it's kind of put you in a new frame of mind for this next season of your life. Give us a little bit of that story and what that moment meant to you, and how that's translated into this idea of changing the way you're viewing, not just leadership, but just influence personally and professionally.
Oh, it's such what a great question, Jeff. I mentor a lot of University of Virginia football players and have for about a decade. And when Deshaun Perry, Lavelle Davis, and Devin Chandler came home from a field trip on a Sunday night doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing and were murdered on a bus, murdered on what functionally was serving as a school bus on a Sunday night, the day after a game. You know, the bounce back for me from like the Payne Stewart tragedy was resilient. It was, you know, go on, you know, build it. I really thought that I would help lead this community through a heroic return, and it killed me. I'm not going to lie. It took a year, and it turned me inside out and forced me to reinvent myself. And this is what I've learned. What I've learned is that fear is fatal, and the sum total of my life has caused me to rely on faith, the faith that's the most meaningful for me in my higher power, but also to take a good hard look at the people that I'm dealing with, both the people that I lead and our customers, in a negotiation of friendship. And that is the reality that we're all spending 99% of our times thinking about ourselves, and none of us are being very nice to the person that we're thinking about. And that if you can translate real empathy and introduce it and find a way to think of what's in it for the people you're dealing with, whether you're managing them or whether you're trying to do business with them, that if you just sit, listen long enough and trust that you're going to do the best that you can, something got you this far. You are talking to someone who is suffering just like you are. So why would you double down on both of you by being anything other than empathetic? So you can be disciplined, you can have integrity, you can be tough as nails, but you can also be empathetic, because we all need someone to remind us that we shouldn't be in any business killing ourselves, that self-care is best achieved by thinking about what's in it for another human being. You can disagree with someone and love them and empathize with them at the same time. And if you introduce that into your dealings, it's transformational. I had to do that to survive. That was the lesson that I learned. And about a year after practicing some new principles and really getting close to my faith, about a year after the shooting, I woke up one day and the fear was gone, because something got me through all those trials early in life. Something got me through college. Something has been at work in my life from my first memory. And if I give myself completely to that, worst thing that can happen is I'm left alone with my God, my faith. And that's been pretty good. So I have an awesome family.
Pressure's off, right? Take the pressure off.
Take all the pressure off. And so there is no pressure. And in a simplified term, it's the golden rule. Love your neighbor as yourself. You can have a position. You can articulate it. But you can't make another human being feel anything. You can only be a mirror and an example. And you can lead anybody. But you have to have empathy to do it effectively. I do. And that's been the greatest lesson for me, and one that I hope to build on. And when I get a real job, when I grow up, and when I finally grow up, what I would love to do is help other people navigate their fear to just release themselves, to stop killing themselves, stressing about what they're doing wrong. Because every day that they get up, they suit up, show up, do their best, try not to make the same mistake twice. Something got them this far. We can all make the world a better place, and it's going to happen one human being at a time. And that's what I'm here for.
So that's incredible. What a great way to close down this episode. And it's been such an honor to unpack your journey with our audience. And I know that people have undoubtedly seen their own story through yours in so many different ways. And as you think about this next chapter in your life, this would be the last question, I guess. So you gave a good bow tie on your lessons learned and what you've taken away from that journey. But if you had an ideal vision board for Billy Curry in the second half here, right? Because hopefully you're just at halftime.
That's right.
What does that look like for you?
I want to be a purveyor of things that are ultimately useful for the greater good for more people. And I don't know how that's going to happen. I'm not going to say, I have circled a date out in my future, and I am making very intentional steps in that direction to put everything on paper that I've learned over the years, candidly. And I do, I have 11 principles that I live and die by, and that I manage by, and I manage directly to, and they have proven to be useful over the course of my life. And I want to find a way to minister mainly to men who've been through what I've been through, to release them, to help them find what it's going to take to make them the most useful members of their communities and families themselves. That's about as specific as I can be. Obviously, doing it in a commercial venture, it's possible, and doing it in any job, but long term, I want to eradicate hopelessness from men like me. Because it's tragic to see the amounts of it in our culture right now. And whatever it takes to help as many people as possible, whether it's mentorship, I just want to make that a bigger emphasis in my life. So this is chapter one. We're going to find out what's going to happen in the future, Jeff. But this has been such a blessing. Just getting the opportunity to record this has been awesome. And we'll see where it goes. I am enthusiastic, though, about this, and really appreciate the opportunity to share.
Well, I love it. I love your vision. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, what I heard, there's at least at minimum, there's a book in the future coming out. So, I mean, I'm not going to say that was a thus saith the Lord or anything, Bill, but I did hear that's in there. And I did hear that you're going to probably be going around speaking at some point in a more intentional way to teach these 11 principles. And you're going to be rising. You're going to be using your skills and talents to raise up a new generation of men who maybe didn't have the kind of mentorship that you can provide. And they just need someone to speak that kind of truth into their life. So for what that's worth, that's what I heard you say you're going to be doing.
That's what I'm feeling, buddy. And my dad has written 2 books and, you know, ironically, there's 11 men in a football huddle. And I don't think that's an accident. And so more will be revealed, but I'm going to keep showing up. I can promise you that.
I love it. Well, thanks again. We'd love to have you back on. And any updates you have to this story that are meaningful that we would want to bring you back on and let you share that with our audience, let alone if not the world, right? So thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeff, man. Have a great day.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.